طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Omar Badar is a political analyst, digital producer, and human rights advocate based in Washington, D.C. He holds a master's degree in international relations and is a deputy director of the American Arab Institute. He recently gave a marvelous presentation at the Community Church of Boston, and we feature that for you today on This Week in Palestine. Here he is speaking with moderator Dean Stevens.
Omar Badar, welcome. And we're so glad to have you. And we welcome all of you who are on Zoom to join us, and we will do a Q&A later on. Thank you, Omar.
And I don't know, 20 years of speaking, this was by far the best introduction I've ever had, so I really appreciate it. As Dean has mentioned, it feels incredibly special for me to actually be here with you all today. This was my first job out of grad school 16 years ago in Boston with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, where I piled all of my personal belongings in a car and drove from Memphis to Boston. 20-hour drive altogether. And yeah, this place actually means a lot to me, and being here is really incredibly heartwarming. So thank you very much for the invite and for all the work that you all are doing in this space. And it's really incredible to have a community space that actually hosts events like these on a regular basis. It's very heartwarming and special. As far as Palestine is concerned, it is honestly a deeply frustrating situation where the injustice that Palestinians face is incredibly glaring. There is no moral ambiguity about what is unfolding in Palestine. It is as glaring and as obvious as Jim Crow was in the U.S., as apartheid was in South Africa, British colonization of India, and the examples are many in which when we look back, we don't think in terms of both sides and counter-arguments and right and wrong and it's complicated or any of that. And yet, the media portrayal in the United States of the issue of Palestine is very much one of false equivalence, one of victim blaming, and one of missing context, in a way that Americans get, frankly, disproportionate coverage of what happens in Israel and Palestine compared to many other places in the world that go unnoticed. And yet, the coverage is so bad that all this coverage that you receive does not actually enhance people's understanding of what is unfolding, precisely because it lacks context. It doesn't explain that Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. It doesn't explain that the West Bank and Gaza are under an illegal occupation as recognized by the entire international community. It doesn't say anything about the fact that now every major human rights organization acknowledges that Palestinians live under a permanent system of Israeli apartheid. That never comes up in coverage. And so the coverage is typically Palestinian children throw rocks, a soldier fires his gun, somebody dies, what happened, you know, was it justified shooting or this or that, ignoring entirely the fact that the soldier does not belong there in the first place, that this is a Palestinian city, a Palestinian town, and that the presence of the Israeli soldiers there is illegal and entirely based on enforcing and imposing a system of illegal apartheid. And every phase of the so-called conflict is just an escalation of outrages that ought to be making the moral clarity on this issue more and more obvious to everyone. And yet we have a discourse in this country that is really deeply broken and prevents that. from the ethnic cleansing at the founding of Israel, literally an entire country founded on the premise of privileging one group of people over another, and at the expense of hundreds of thousands of people who were thrown out of their homes and driven out of their land, and hundreds of Palestinian towns and villages that were completely destroyed and wiped out in order to prevent those refugees from ever returning. And you, nonetheless, this became a state recognized by the international community, a member of the United Nations. And you fast forward to 1967, and Israel launches another war, expanding itself substantially, occupying lands from neighboring countries. That occupation is recognized as illegal by the international community. Not illegal, just technically. The international community demands its end, says you cannot acquire territory by force. And so the status of those territories is accepted as occupied territories that Israel is obligated to withdraw from. And then we had a fake peace process in the 1990s, in which there was this massive Palestinian compromise, where the Palestinian leadership, partly representative, not entirely, of the wishes of the Palestinian people, nonetheless, they made the great compromise of saying, fine, we will recognize Israel as it is recognized by the UN, and the expectation is that in return, Israel would adhere to international law and withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, to facilitate the creation of a small Palestinian state on nearly 20% of historic Palestine. So that's the land division. The land division is 80% goes to Israel and 20% is left to become a Palestinian state. It's an insane compromise when you think about it, considering the fact that this was all historic Palestine. Palestinians rejected the initial plan to partition the land because it made no sense to just give up half your country for no reason. And yet, despite that massive compromise in the late 80s, of which it became the basis for what is often touted as the two-state solution that is still talked about, Israel, instead of withdrawing from the occupied territories, in fact, entrenched its occupation of those occupied territories. They were pretending to negotiate for peace and a possible withdrawal, but the reality is that the settler population in the occupied territories kept expanding further and further until there was no pretense anymore, just by the facts on the ground, that Israel was interested in allowing Palestinian self-determination to exist in any part of Palestine. And that's why the peace process was revealed to be a facade. It's a fraud. It's a sham designed to steal away Palestinian land while pretending to engage in a peace process for the sake of avoiding international pressure. And today, the current Israeli government does not make any pretense about being interested in a two-state solution or withdrawing or ending the occupation or allowing any kind of Palestinian self-determination. The current Israeli government is openly embracing a vision of apartheid in which Palestinians live permanently without rights. Some Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are second-class citizens. They enjoy some rights. They get to participate partially in Israeli democracy, quote-unquote. They can vote. They can run for office. Some are members of the Knesset. But the system is rigged against them so that they can never gain any meaningful power or control of their own lives and their reality. If you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, there are restrictions on who you can marry. You can't just marry another Palestinian from the occupied territories or somebody from a neighboring country. That's not allowed. But if you're a Jewish citizen of Israel, then you can marry anybody from anywhere in the world. And anybody who's Jewish can automatically become a citizen of Israel. Meanwhile, the very Palestinians who were driven out of their homes during the creation of Israel are not allowed to return to their homes. That's the reality for Palestinians living. And there's also quite open discrimination. When you think in a U.S. context, you think if you try to buy a house and somebody says, oh, you're this race or that religion and that's the reason why I'm not going to sell you this house, that is an immediate lawsuit. And you know you're going to win that lawsuit if anything is ever made that explicit about the reason why I did not get a house. In Israel, there are housing admission committees that check whether you are, quote, culturally suitable to live in a particular neighborhood. Very, very thinly veiled code for whether you're Jewish or not. And when cases of discrimination went to the Supreme Court, the Israeli Supreme Court, which is touted everywhere right now when you look at the coverage, is like the progressive bastion, liberal bastion that's going to protect Israeli democracy and liberal values. That court said those housing admission committees are perfectly legal and legitimate, and there's nothing wrong with them. That's the reality for Palestinians within Israel, as recognized by the UN. And then you have Palestinians who are living in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem who have no rights at all. The government that controls their lives is the Israeli government. They can't go in and out of the areas that they live in. They can't even go between the areas within the West Bank, for example, without running through Israeli security checkpoints. And even though their lives are controlled entirely by the Israeli government, they have no say in the Israeli government at all. They can't participate in those elections. And so Israel has a system in which it rules over millions of Palestinians while denying them the most basic elementary human rights. In fact, you have a situation in which settlers who are living illegally within the West Bank have full rights, can participate fully in Israeli democracy, again, democracy in quotes, given the fact that it's an apartheid system. And immediately next to them, Palestinians living right next to those illegal settlements live under a completely different set of laws, in which Palestinian children are thrown in military detention where they are regularly abused and tortured and denied access to a lawyer and denied access to seeing their parents, and all kinds of abuses go on. And that military system, Israel is the only country in the world that actually processes children through a military detention and military court system. That's the reality for Palestinians who are living right next door. And that's obviously apartheid. It's obviously a system of segregation that is based entirely on whether you're Jewish or not. And it's great that we're finally at a moment in which human rights organizations have gotten around to saying these kinds of things more explicitly. But we have a problem with the fact that we have worse than the media, right? When we talk about the way American media covers this stuff, you've got the false equivalents. But when you think about the way the American government engages with this, it is far, far worse than a false equivalence. It is, in fact, full support for the oppressor party and an inversion of reality in which the oppressors are the oppressed and they're the ones who deserve and need American support. That is a moral stain on America's conscience, the fact that this is American policy and has been going on for decades and decades. For perspective, the United States intervened at the United Nations to shield Israel from international accountability more than 50 times since the 1970s to today. That is more than the number of all vetoes cast by all other members of the UN Security Council combined on all issues for that same period. So American policy is Israel is a nation that is above the law. They can't be held accountable in the same way that any other country can. And it's kind of funny because the discourse from pro-Israel organizations, so-called pro-Israel organizations in the U.S., is that Israel is being singled out for criticism. And why are you holding Israel to a double standard? Frankly, the double standard is being held in the opposite direction. Israel is being treated like a country above the law. And worse than American interventions in the United Nations is material U.S. military support for Israel. With the exception of particular incidents like the invasion of Afghanistan or the invasion of Iraq or currently the U.S. involvement in Ukraine, barring those particular incidents, just looking at it in terms of a long-term trend, Israel is the single largest recipient of U.S. military funding. Currently, Israel receives $3.8 billion every single year in military funding. Most of that military funding comes back to U.S. military corporations. So we have this corrupt system right now in which we all understand what the military-industrial complex is, and part of that is also aid to foreign apartheid nations that are currently engaged in war crimes and crimes against humanity as documented by every major human rights organization in the world, and frankly, including Israeli human rights organizations who are also very critical of Israeli policy. And even though establishment discourse on this is incredibly lopsided in a way that is frankly infuriating, and even though media coverage remains somewhat, it's a relative world, right? Media coverage used to be as bad as American political establishment pronouncements in terms of flipping the narrative entirely. The fact that they use false equivalences now, and you know, that are devoid of context is in a bizarre way an improvement over what it used to be, but obviously nowhere where it needs to be. And in spite of those challenges, the extent of the activism that so many people have engaged in the United States in support of Palestinian human rights to inform the American public about what is happening has actually caused a shift in American public opinion, particularly on the liberal progressive end of the spectrum, to a point now that a majority of Democrats actually support cutting funding, military funding from Israel because of Israel's human rights violations against Palestinians. And yet, that is completely out of sync with the way the party actually functions. It's not unique to this issue. There are many issues in which there is a big gap between American policy and what public opinion demands, and this one is no different. And part of this is based on the mythology that the Israel lobby is not to be crossed. That is part of what sustains this fear among the establishment to really be critical of Israeli policy. AIPAC brags about its influence. AIPAC is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the leading pro-Israel organization in the U.S., with a budget of tens of millions of dollars, probably over $100 million at this point as well, a year. And they're touted by members of Congress. When members of Congress are asked about which organizations are the most influential on Capitol Hill, AIPAC is very frequently one of the names that actually comes up. And they themselves brag about the extent of their influence on policymaking on Capitol Hill, to the point to where one senior AIPAC official at some point, sitting down with Jeffrey Goldberg, who was a pro-Israel journalist working at The Atlantic, he said, during the course of that conversation, picked up a blank napkin off of the table and said, within 24 hours, I can have the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin, regardless of what it might say. I mean, that is an organization that is, again, bragging about the extent of its power and influence. But frankly, that power and influence is inflated. Some of it is smoke and mirrors. I'm not going to pretend that all of it is. But we have a situation right now in which more and more members of Congress on the progressive end of the spectrum are willing to criticize Israeli policy. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and AOC and Cori Bush, and the list is very, very slowly and gradually growing, of people who are willing to speak truth to power, who are willing to say that American policy is wrong, that Israel is an apartheid state, that Palestinians are suffering an injustice, and that American policy needs to change, and the Israel lobby is not able to defeat them. They're still sitting members of Congress. That does not have absolute consistency, of course. AIPAC and the pro-Israel lobby have been able to defeat other members of Congress, and frankly, for sometimes more tepid criticism. Somebody like Andy Levin is a pro-Israel member of Congress, but nonetheless, he was critical of the Netanyahu government, talked about the need to end the occupation and support a two-state solution, and so on. And for these tepid crimes, AIPAC turned on him and was able to oust him from power. But at least it's a fight. At least this boogeyman, the idea, the image of AIPAC as an all-powerful lobby that you can't cross, has been broken. And we need the American political establishment to catch up to that reality because, frankly, it is not as politically costly to speak truth to power on this issue. It is not as politically costly as politicians imagine to be on the right side of history on this question. You have this mythology in America that when we look at America's original sins, when you think about what the United States has done to Native Americans, there is an assumption in the way we talk about this that, of course, it's a colossal injustice, but it was a long time ago, and if something like that were to happen again, of course, it would be different this time. Where now, we have different values. We have very progressive values, and we're very thoughtful and compassionate and anti-racist and all these wonderful things. But that reality is unfolding somewhere else right now. Palestinians are being driven off of their land right now by a colonizing force and are on the receiving end of war crimes, the indiscriminate bombing of civilian areas, the deliberate targeted killing of journalists and medics. These things are unfolding right now, and U.S. policy is to support it. So that pretense that our values have fundamentally changed or we're a different country now is something to be really taken with a grain of salt. What had changed is that Americans' tolerance and knowledge about particular situations has shifted and applied enough pressure on the political establishment to change the policy. And that is precisely what is needed at this point. Now, given this massive shift in American public opinion on this, again, particularly on the liberal end of the spectrum, nonetheless, there is a significant shift. The pro-Israel lobby and pro-Israel organizations are beginning to see the writing on the wall in terms of the way the discourse is moving, the way public opinion is shifting, and the extent to which the Israeli government has become so extreme and so blatant that you simply can't defend it on the merits. And so they shifted to different tactics. Now when they lobby against members of Congress that they don't like, they don't talk about Israel and Palestine. They know that's not a winning issue. They pour endless money to defeat progressives who are supportive of Palestinian human rights, but they do it by attacking them on other issues, not on this issue, because they can recognize that this issue is not a winning issue for them anymore. And because the more we talk about this, the more clear that injustice becomes to everyone, now the primary tactic has been shifted to stifling free speech and open discussion on this issue here in the United States. Apartheid is so indefensible, and the statements of Israeli politicians are so egregious that you can no longer win the debate if you're siding with apartheid. People will see through it. And in lieu of that, it became about defeating our ability to have this conversation. And there are two battles over free speech in the United States when it comes to this issue. The first one is the battle for the right to boycott not just Israel, but even Israeli settlements, which are recognized as war crimes under international law. There are legislations being passed all over the country that makes it punishable for Americans not just to boycott Israel, but to boycott Israeli settlements. And really just pause and reflect on that for a moment. In a country that is where the right to boycott is really foundational to the country, you know, the boycott of British tea at the founding of the country, the Montgomery bus boycott at the height of the civil rights movement. The right to boycott is enshrined in the Constitution. It is protected. The Supreme Court says it is a core part of the First Amendment. And yet, now you have states passing laws saying that to boycott a foreign country's war crimes can cause retaliation from your own government against you. That is an insane and transparently illegal position. And thankfully, the ACLU and many other organizations are fighting these cases when people have standing to actually fight against them. When you hear of teachers denied contracts at the universities because they're not signing a pledge to not boycott Israel and all these sorts of things. And these cases are being won in many different states. Those laws, those transparently illegal laws to undermine free speech, are being defeated. But the pace at which those lawsuits are being won can't keep up with the extent to which this legislation is spread across the entire country in many, many different states and local legislatures and so on. And the second battle is the one that is over the definition of anti-Semitism. The weaponization of anti-Semitism, and I want to be clear that anti-Semitism is obviously an extremely serious problem. We've seen it especially rise to new heights during the Trump era, with synagogues being on the receiving ends of shootings. This is a problem that deserves our attention. And to watch people weaponize that charge in order not to combat anti-Semitism, but to try to stifle free and open debate about human rights issues in Palestine, is particularly contemptible. And yet that is precisely what's happening. There is an effort throughout the nation right now to adopt something that is called the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. That is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition. That definition was developed by a man named Ken Stern. And Ken Stern developed it, and it's widely used by the State Department, for the sake of foreign data collection. And Ken Stern said this definition, which conflates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, Ken Stern says this was deliberately made to be overly broad and overly loose for the sake of foreign data collection, and that trying to adopt it domestically in the United States would cause very serious problems for free speech and would actually stifle open and legitimate political discussion about Israel and Palestine. That is the author's take on how this definition could be misused and how it should not be misused. And yet, that has not stopped many organizations from pushing for this to be adopted domestically as the definition of anti-Semitism, to be employed in campus harassment, incidents where somebody holds a pro-Palestine event and somebody says that's anti-Semitic harassment, and then people find themselves on the receiving end of civil rights lawsuits and all sorts of things. And that definition, I mean, just to talk about, just to get a little bit more precise about what it does, it says that to demonize Israel is anti-Semitism. It says to judge Israel by double standards is anti-Semitism. To describe Israel as a racist endeavor is anti-Semitism. Those are examples of things that couldn't count as anti-Semitism. But I'm sorry, if the founding of an entire country was based on privileging one group of people over another, and when you think of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were driven out of their homes in order for Israel to be established, you are saying that Palestinians merely recounting factually what happened to them is anti-Semitism. And that's insane. And when you talk about demonizing Israel, who gets to define what demonization is? Where do you draw the line between what is legitimate criticism and what is not? Obviously, it's overly broad and vague that it could very easily be weaponized for people who are engaged in legitimate criticism to be falsely accused of anti-Semitism. And you have the double standard thing. You know, there's a disclaimer at the bottom of the IRA definition that says, criticism of Israel that is similar to criticism of other nations is not anti-Semitism. And that's the fig leaf that many people use to say there's nothing wrong with this definition. But what does it mean to criticize Israel within the confines of criticism that is equal to that of other nations? If Israel is engaged in the only modern, longest military occupation in history, are you not allowed to say that because you can't say that about other countries? How many countries right now are modern apartheid states? Not many. And so obviously, and especially from a U.S. perspective, when Israel is the single largest recipient of U.S. military aid, frankly, there is every reason to focus more on Israel than you focus on some random country that is engaged in human rights violations, but is not receiving its funding from the U.S., not from our tax dollars. We're not morally responsible for what China does or what Iran does, or, you know, there are many countries that abuse human rights, and the U.S. doesn't have a hand in all of it. But we, as Americans living in this country, our money is going to fund particular countries' human rights violations, and so there's a reason to focus disproportionately on those countries, and that can't be described as anti-Semitism. And to show you a little bit of how cynical this process is, there is a guy by the name of Ken Marcus, who used to be at the Brandeis Center, incidentally, who during the Obama administration used to file harassment cases with the Office of Civil Liberties at the Department of Education, alleging that every pro-Palestine event that takes place on a campus is an example of anti-Semitic harassment. And what Obama's Department of Education did, the Office of Civil Liberties there, is went through the cases, and with every single time, they would reply and say, sorry, we've investigated. This is not a case of anti-Semitism, and this is just legitimate speech about foreign policy issues that is protected by the First Amendment. And when Ken Marcus was asked about that, he said, it is fine that we're not winning those cases. Just getting students entangled in a civil rights complaint is enough to discourage what he described as quote-unquote anti-Israel students from being able to organize and gather support. So Ken Marcus's vision is explicitly one in which he is bringing trumped-up charges against people in order to discourage advocacy for Palestinian human rights. That is his agenda. And another thing happened during the Obama administration is that there was an attempt to pass congressional legislation to define anti-Semitism by this IRA definition. And because the ACLU and many other civil rights organizations mobilized against it, that congressional effort failed. Then comes in Donald Trump, who passes this definition as the definition by executive order, bypassing Congress entirely, and then appoints Ken Marcus, the very person who's fighting to undermine the right of students to have free expression on campus, and appoints him to be the head of the Office of Civil Liberties at the Department of Education. And thankfully, because there isn't adequate knowledge and support about the Palestine issue, turned out that Ken Marcus is also homophobic, has a lot of glaring anti-LGBT views, and eventually basically was pushed out of his post due to pressure. But you can imagine a world in which he had been allowed to set policy, in which the very office that is protecting students' right to free speech ends up being under the control of somebody whose job is to undermine students' right to free expression on this particular issue. But none of this matters because the trajectory is pretty clear. in a way, it seems implausible that Israel can continue behaving the way it does and the American people to continue ignoring it. But the reality is that we don't have the luxury of kicking back and saying, the arc of history bends towards justice, so it's fine, it's all going to work out, don't worry too much about it. Because every single day that goes on under the system is another day in which a mother may lose her children either to sniper fire or to military detention, in which a family might lose their home. This is an ongoing atrocity in which every day this occupation and apartheid system is allowed to continue standing is a day in which countless lives are continuing to be ruined on a daily basis. We have a reality in which there's never going to be long-term peace unless there is justice. And justice means that Israel has to recognize that Palestinians are equal human beings who are deserving of every bit of freedom and dignity and human rights as every Israeli. And until we get to that point, we are stuck in an ugly cycle, and the U.S., as the only country, let me correct that, not the only country, but the only country with leverage over Israel, that the extent of American support for Israel gives the U.S. very significant leverage to actually change Israeli behavior, we also have a moral responsibility to fight for a change in our government, in our policy, in engaging in every way that we possibly can in order to create that shift. And through that, hopefully we can one day see peace and we can cleanse our hands and cleanse this country from perhaps one of the biggest foreign policy failures, moral failures that we've had that has been going on for many, many decades. I'll leave it at that, and I'm happy to just open it up for discussion and Q&A from here. I don't know how we want to do the Q&A from...
We'll also mention that another good friend, Miko Pellet, is a black belt karate instructor, and I think dropped out because of an injury, but has recently been seen on social media with his karate gear on again. So that's a beautiful thing.
May I receive one? How do you think we can help Palestinians free themselves from this horrible situation? Because they are the ones that need the help right now. But the other thing is that I wonder if the fact that the public opinion in the U.S. is changing, which is a good thing, maybe not so good since Israel, as they know that this is changing, are speeding up to destroy as soon as possible every Palestinian they can find, because they know it's the end. They're going to have to stop. So they'll, you know, it's a counter, it may be counterproductive, in fact, that we are changing and that we are being fair, because they are unfair.
I'll take the second question first, and I'll flip into what we can do. There was a time at the beginning of, again, the so-called peace process where Israel was nervous about the possibility that the U.S. is going to be engaging as an honest broker and actually apply meaningful pressure on Israel to end the occupation. And so the advice of leading Israeli politicians at the time is for the settlers to go and run and grab as many hilltops as possible, because anything they don't take immediately will probably end up with the Palestinians. Turns out the U.S. was not serious at all about engaging in a peace process, and so this effort to run and grab everything has gone on from that day until today and is ongoing. The attitude that you're describing is partly correct in the sense that Israel is escalating its land theft and its violence, and you have a government so extreme right now that it is not hyperbole to be nervous about the possibility of another Nakba happening. Nakba is the event at Israel's founding, the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians, where the majority of the people in the land were driven out of their homes. And frankly, that event never ended. We talk about the Nakba as a historical event, as if it's something that happened once in history. But when you look at the fundamental foundation of everything that Israel has done since, you really can describe the Nakba as an ongoing process. And we are witnessing a particularly dangerous moment right now in which the world's attention is elsewhere. Obviously, Ukraine and Russia is dominating foreign policy headlines in a place like the U.S., in which, even though this conversation is becoming more contentious in the U.S. very slowly, Israel may see the current political orientation, the current establishment, as one of the final moments of unquestionable American support, and that this is the time to do something worse to be able to get away with it. And they would not be entirely wrong, frankly. I don't know if the Biden administration has either the moral courage or the appetite to take on this fight. If something horrible were to happen, would they do anything more than use empty words of condemnation? I don't have any confidence at all that the Biden administration would do anything more than that. And that's the reality. And you have an Israeli government right now, including ministers who were convicted of anti-Palestinian incitement and terrorism by the apartheid regime. So by Israel's own standards, some of these people are too extreme, and yet they are the ones who currently dominate the cabinet of this government. So it is a very, very dangerous situation. There's no question about it. It's difficult, honestly, to know what intervention would be possible in the short term. But obviously, in terms of what we can do, there are many organizations that are trying to help Palestinians on a humanitarian level. PCRF, the Palestinian Children Relief Fund, and many others. And from my perspective, for those of us who live in the U.S., I feel like we have a particularly unique role given what U.S. policy is. And for me, the pressure ought to be applying overwhelmingly. Not for the sake of changing this administration's policy in any fundamental way, because I don't think that that's realistic at all, but in making it really politically costly for them to continue ignoring this issue and behaving the way that they are, to shore up more progressive challenges and support, to give people who are more outspoken on this issue a chance to actually win a better election. The only people who were speaking, again, it's a relative world, much better than anything that the establishment has said before, were people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in the last election, floating the idea of withholding some U.S. military support for Israel until Gaza siege is over, until Palestinians have improved lives, things of that sort. And Biden came back with saying that U.S. military support for Israel is not to be questioned and can never be conditioned. That is his position. In the face of people who are asking for extremely minimal and tepid levels of accountability, and Biden does not feel the pressure just for the sake of pretending he supports human rights, when this is a lot of what he talks about a human rights first policy and so on, I think it's time to turn up the heat on this administration and just to make it clear that they can't continue getting away with not being serious on this issue. It's incredible that the discourse around Ukraine and Russia is that we have to give billions in weapons to Ukraine because they must resist foreign occupation. And American policy in Israel and Palestine is to give billions in weapons to the occupiers to impose an occupation. It's a level of hypocrisy that ought to be called out at every turn. And I think in whatever ways that we can apply pressure politically, in the media, in every way possible, to make them answer for that hypocrisy and to create a political climate that encourages future progressives to be more outspoken on this issue and make it the center of their foreign policy, I think is where, in my view, energy should be poured.
Yvonne.
Yes. I know that there are Orthodox Jews that support Palestinians in Israel. Is that correct? Some. Oh, not all. Okay. Okay. There's another. So the other question is that, you know, I have Jewish friends who are not politically involved or anything, but when I say, you know, this is not right, they say, well, if the United States did not support Israel, it would be invaded by all these Arab countries surrounding it.
That is nothing short of mythology. You have a reality right now. Again, it's, by the way, very, very effective imagery, right? Tiny, fragile country surrounded by enemies and needs all the support in the world. The reality is the entire Arab world presented something called the Arab Peace Initiative to Israel in 2002, led by Saudi Arabia, that said the entire Arab world would fully normalize relations with Israel. And by the way, these are countries that whose support for Palestinians is largely symbolic. It's feeling the popular pressure from their populations to be standing in solidarity with Palestinians. But many of these governments that are authoritarian and dictatorial really see the Palestinian issue as a burden. Many of them are just eager to normalize with Israel because of all the benefits of kind of getting more embedded in the U.S.-Israeli military orbit. But for them, they know that their populations would be hostile to normalizing a country that is oppressing their brethren in Palestine. And that's a big part of why these countries support Palestinians. They nonetheless made a peace offer in 2002 that said every country would have full normal relations with Israel if Israel simply ended the occupation and didn't even demand a full right of return for the refugees, but merely said, find a just solution for the refugees, which is kind of a just watered down language that says, whatever, when it comes to refugees, just end the occupation of 22% of historic Palestine and you'll have full relations. And Israel's answer is no. Israel's answer is, even if giving up 22% of the land that Israel is obligated to leave, right? This is not, nobody's asking for concessions from Israel. I see this kind of discourse a lot on Twitter of people talking about what would it take to get Israel to make concessions. These are not concessions. Giving back something that you stole is not a concession. You're obligated to give back something that you stole. And these countries are saying, stop stealing other people's land and we'll normalize with you. And Israel's answer is no. So that vision of a fragile Israel that is worried about its relations with its neighbors is a complete fiction. And we're seeing a demonstration of that right now with the so-called Abraham Accords that Trump was leading on. Getting countries that were privately already in cahoots with Israel, they're already in alliance, to simply make that alliance public in exchange for large military contracts and gifts and things of that sort, and that being sold as a historic peace deal. Peace deal between countries that were never in conflict to begin with. Meanwhile, the only quote-unquote conflict that matters is the fact that Palestinians are being denied human rights, and that's the source of the entire problem. That is the source, that is the driving core force of the violence that we're witnessing. Overwhelmingly violence against Palestinians, but also occasionally violence against Israelis. And that has never been touched. Israel has never been serious about ending that. And from the perspective of Israeli leaders, it's a cost they're willing to take, that there's the occasional stabbing or occasional attack here or there, that in the long run, being able to take all of the land and to maintain full control over Palestinians, that these kinds of attacks are a small price to pay and they're perfectly fine with it. That's the reality.
Hi, Omar. Thanks so much for that great talk. I have two completely unrelated questions that I'm really interested in hearing. I'm not interested in that. I am interested, they're not connected questions, but I'm interested just to hear your analysis of the siege of the Jenin refugee camp this summer. What was the decision calculus? Why did Israel do it? What did they gain from it? And sort of the aftermath of that. That's one question I have. And maybe if you care to also comment on the status of like the resistance forces in Jenin. And then my other question is just, you're talking about the Biden administration and how things are likely to get significantly worse for Palestinians. That just made me think about the upcoming election. And so maybe can you talk about the stakes of the presidential election for Palestine and for Palestinians, potential second Trump administration?
All right. On the Jenin refugee camp. Jenin is a hub of Palestinian militant resistance to Israeli occupation. And in a way, it is an inevitable outcome of any prolonged occupation in which there's no political prospect for an end to that oppression. Again, at a time when there was hope for a peaceful settlement, at early days of the peace process before it was uncovered that it was a complete sham, Palestinian public opinion was actually hostile to people who were engaged in violence. It was like, don't mess this up. We might be able to get our freedom through a political process. Once it became clear that Israel has absolutely no interest in ending the occupation, no interest in relinquishing control over the lives of Palestinians, public opinion on this kind of issue naturally shifted. There was a lot more support for meaningful armed resistance. The idea that Israel took this land by force and therefore we have to liberate it by force is a mainstream view in Palestine. And the Palestinian Authority functions effectively as an extension of the Israeli occupation. They were brought in, just a little bit of history on that real quick, if that's all right. The Palestinian Authority was created during the first Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, in the late 80s. And the situation was getting out of Israel's control. Palestinians were rebelling. It was overwhelmingly an unarmed rebellion. And instead of killing protesters, because that was garnering too much bad coverage for Israel, Israeli politicians instructed their military people to break the bones of Palestinians instead. And what they thought was going to be a way to mitigate the human the PR disaster, once channels all around the world started airing footage of Israeli soldiers literally beating Palestinians with rocks until their arms were broken, ended up generating obviously a lot more outrage. The situation was out of Israel's hands, and they did not know what to do with that Palestinian uprising that was demanding an end to that occupation. And so they found a way to defuse the situation by negotiating with the PLO, bringing in Yasser Arafat, and creating a symbolic peace process to kind of defuse the situation. And they brought the Palestinian Authority in. They allowed Yasser Arafat to create a Palestinian Authority, and they said there will be a Palestinian state in 5 years, and dangled that carrot in front of him and said, all you got to do is make sure that you quell any Palestinian violence. And the Palestinian Authority did that very, very well. They actually cracked down on any kind of violent resistance to Israeli occupation, and gave members of the Palestinian Authority all kinds of privileges. You know, Palestinians live a very difficult life under occupation, not members of the Palestinian Authority. They can travel in and out. They can move around much more freely. They get all kinds of lucrative deals. They get a lot of support from other countries that lines up the pockets of many people in the PA. And you've created a dependency right now that even though Israel has made it clear that it's no longer interested, never was, it's made it clear that it's not interested in creating a Palestinian state, the Palestinian Authority remains nonetheless dependent on Israel for all the privileges that they currently get. And the prospect of resisting Israel in any meaningful way could be responded to very, you know, would just destroy the lives of people who are currently very privileged. And it's almost in a way understandable that if you have a privileged life, why would you want to end up like Yasser Arafat? Yasser Arafat, once he actually stopped playing the role of stooge in support of Israeli occupation, he was ultimately besieged in his home. Israeli security forces, quote-unquote security forces, occupation troops, invaded the building that he was at, killed a lot of his personal security guards, and then Yasser Arafat ultimately died under suspicious circumstances. There's a lot of speculation, an Al Jazeera investigation that suggests that Israel may have been behind his killing, perfectly plausible. But that is the future that awaits people who decide to become a thorn in Israel's side. And so the Palestinian Authority to this day plays the role of cracking down on any kind of Palestinian violence or resistance to occupation, but without the political vision that they're going to lead to anything positive beyond the symbolic pronouncements of we will fight forever and this and that. And so resistance is naturally growing elsewhere. That is getting out of the control of the Palestinian Authority. In fact, there are sometimes members of the Palestinian Authority who receive their guns and weapons with the approval of Israel, turning against the PA and actually playing a role of supporting some of these armed resistance factions. So Israel is recognizing that the PA is losing control, and that's a very, very serious concern for them. And one of the places in which the PA does not have any control is in a place like Jenin that has become a very significant hub for Palestinian militant activity. And Israel's policy in Jenin is essentially a copy of Israel's policy in Gaza. You don't want to get fully embroiled in the day-to-day occupation of that area, but you'll go in every now and then to, quote-unquote, mow the lawn, is the terminology that Israeli leaders use. And that is precisely what they did in Jenin. They realized that things were getting out of hand. They went in, they practically destroyed the camp. They drove thousands of people out of their homes and, you know, were able to disrupt militant organizing. I don't think they're ever going to defeat it again. It's just a reality that every oppressed people everywhere in the world who are living under a foreign occupation are going to find ways to resist and organize. And so it's just a matter of time before the groups there regroup and are able to, you know, mount further nuisance in a way to Israel. It's not at the point to where it's a major threat to the occupation, but certainly to be able to take the lives of soldiers every now and then is something that Israel would rather not deal with, and that's why they carry out these operations that they do. Is that good on the first one? So for the question of the U.S. election, we have unfortunately, because anything, the extent to which the discourse was moving in a positive direction was happening on the Democratic Party side. Obviously, the Republicans are just have noticed that there is divisions happening within the Democratic Party on this issue, and they're trying to now play this as a wedge issue against Democrats, and so they're going all in on the Republican side of being. It's hard to even imagine what that looks like, but more rapidly pro-Israel than they've ever been before, and trying to bring it up in every way possible to say that the Democrats are anti-Israel. That's their new talking point. Even people like Obama and Biden, who have pushed U.S. military funding for Israel above any levels that we've ever seen before, they're still painted as anti-Israel because they were critical of this settlement one time or that attack or whatever. And a lot of the Democratic Party establishment is running to defend themselves by saying, no, we're not anti-Israel. In fact, and they start performing, bigger pro-Israel stunts, like this vote that happened in Congress somewhat recently, declaring that Israel is not an apartheid state. It was a laughable vote that happened in the U.S. Congress, where you have Israeli leaders openly talking about the fact that they want to maintain permanent control of Palestinians without giving them any rights, and a reality that many former Israeli politicians and former Israeli military generals are describing as apartheid, and yet the U.S. runs and the Congress gets in line and votes that Israel is not an apartheid state, with just a handful of the usual suspects either abstaining or voting against that resolution. So that's the discourse. And in a reality in which we have a Democratic incumbent running, there's not going to be space made for people who are running within the Democratic Party. Marianne Williamson is running on the Democratic Party. Her position on this issue is far better than Joe Biden's. But we're not going to see it. There's not going to be any Democratic debates. There's not going to be as much coverage of what Marianne Williamson has to say about this particular issue. So the point within the Democratic Party seems to be moot at this point. Outside of the Democratic Party, you have people like Cornel West who are running, who's also very good on this issue. But again, I think we're just facing the same problem, is that in a two-party duopoly and in the way that media discourse on this issue is, there's not going to be breathing room for dissenting voices on this issue. And it seems like we are, if Biden is the better option, it's a very, very depressing reality, but that's the reality that we're actually going into, is somebody who's not going to escalate the harm to the extent that Trump did versus either Trump himself or somebody like Trump. That's the choice that we're facing. And I think that a prospect of a return for somebody like Trump to power, which is certainly plausible, is a very, very scary prospect for many reasons, for us domestically here in the U.S. and certainly for Palestinians as well, to think of a second Trump term in which just there's no reason to hold back anything at all anymore. And somebody who's clearly operating from a much more vengeful place with a much more enticed base that would probably support anything that he's going to do. With every indictment, he loses some people in the center, but he fundraises endlessly and his support and within the core Republican Party grows. And we have a reality now with the endless charges that have been filed against him. He remains the front runner in the Republican Party by a huge margin. That's a scary prospect. And unfortunately, there's nothing been more disappointing to me than the extent to which some people, I'm not going to name them because I don't like the inter-lefty fighting, but there are a lot of people who are trivializing the threat that Trump poses, trivializing what January 6th meant, just trivializing that entire danger, is kind of playing it all as nothing and pretending that Trump is no worse than anybody else, either Republican or Democrat. I don't think that that's a correct vision and a correct approach. I view Trump as a very, very serious threat. We've seen it once before with what he has done, and I don't want to find out what a second Trump term looks like. So to me, that still remains a priority to try to avoid at all costs. But yeah, it's a bleak outlook when it comes to the 2024 election.
You have been listening to a presentation by Palestinian activist Omar Badar speaking at the Community Church of Boston. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC, 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on KKRN.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.